Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January 20th, 2012. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Alyssa Ray, our guest co-host, Nina Laboucan, and our control room tech trainee, Morgan Ahoff. Welcome, everyone. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at cooperadio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. For our first interview today, we will have Peter Fricker on the show. He is the Projects and Communications Director of the Vancouver Humane Society, and he will be speaking with us today about a topic that we have not yet covered before on the show, and that is the issue of keeping exotic animals as pets at home. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, you can only guess what he might have to say about whether keeping a boa constrictor as a pet inside your Vancouver condo is, say, more appropriate for the animal than living in his or her own native environment of the Amazon jungle. Alyssa and Nina, have either of you ever known someone to keep a natively wild animal in their home as a pet? Nina, I think you mentioned before.
Yeah, I had a friend who had a pet iguana for a few years, but he ended up running away a few times, and this time she didn't find him.
And was that in the city?
That was, yeah, it was a mixture between city and sort of rural areas. He was often sick.
So I see a few problems there. Number one, the iguana was often sick. Number two, not a good habitat for the iguana to be running free in, just for the iguana himself. And number three, something that Peter might be touching on, is that it can be actually quite dangerous health-wise for just the environment and other species of animals, and that for non-native species to be mixed with them. So I think we'll be learning more about that in the upcoming interview. For our feature interview today, in anticipation of the upcoming Vancouver debut screening next week of the film Veducated, we have writer, director, and editor of the film, Marisa Miller-Wolfson, to speak with us all about getting Veducated. Veducated is a guerrilla-style documentary that follows three meat and cheese-loving New Yorkers who agree to adopt a vegan diet for 6 weeks and learn what it's all about. I saw this film at the Animal Rights Conference in Los Angeles last summer and had the pleasure of meeting Marisa there herself, and I have to say that this film has been deservingly getting a lot of attention in the AR world, and Marisa was even interviewed on national television last week when she appeared on the Issues with Jane Velez Mitchell show to promote the film. Being an independently produced film with a shoestring budget by a first-time filmmaker, this is a huge stride in the animal rights movement, and it is a film of animal activism, which we will learn more about during the interview. Alyssa, Nina, and Morgan, you three haven't seen the film yet. Are you going to be attending the screening next week?
Yes, I will be going, most definitely. I missed it when I was at the conference last year, so I'm excited.
I haven't heard about it yet, so I'll have to find out the details.
Tuesday at the library.
Alyssa.
yeah, I don't think my mic is on.
Oh, how did that happen?
Mic two, please. Mic three, actually.
Well, it should be three. There we go.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah, I'm definitely attending, and I'm challenging myself to bring at least a couple non-veg friends. My sister has confirmed, and I think maybe someone else. And I said that I would give them a cupcake.
So you have to bribe them.
Yes. Well, my sister
Whatever
said
works,
she's
right?
coming, but I'm going to keep, yeah. Yeah,
that's great. So it is a free film screening presented by the local group Liberation BC, and will be happening next Tuesday, January 24th at 7 p.m. at the Central Vancouver Public Library. So be there and get educated. So before Christmas, i.e. before I was on the strict health kick that I am on now, I was engrossed in a newish vegan dessert book aptly called Vegan Dessert, Sumptuous Sweets for Every Season, written by the lovely and endearingly talented Hannah Kaminsky, who is best known for her bittersweet vegan blog and her first cookbook, My Sweet Vegan, both of which I highly recommend that you check out as well. But this book, Vegan Desserts, is literally a work of art unto itself, from as soon as you eye the hardcover-bound text gleaming with luxurious-looking treats that are beckoning you inside. And inside the book, you'll find over 200 glossy pages boasting beautiful color photographs of each recipe within. And this isn't your average dessert book here, all originally conceived with the accompanying stories of origination to go along. Hannah's creative culinary genius presents you with outstanding recipes such as for avocado cream pie, zesty rhubarb ripple cake, raspberry mocha semifreddo, and no-bake pumpkin creme brulee. And as intimidating as these titles may sound to the beginner in the kitchen, it's Hannah's accessible and fun demeanor infused throughout her words in the book that make you eager to tackle the recipes with as much joy as you can feel she gets from creating the recipes herself. I appreciated the thoroughness of each recipe presentation, from the photographs to the clear instructions to the extra tips for success that were there to guide you along the way. And for the adventurous baker, there is no shortage here of new recipes to try that will challenge your skills in the kitchen as well as satisfy your high-end palate for textures and flavors combined. I shouldn't forget to explain the subtitle of the book, which is Sumptuous Sweets for Every Season. Yes, to add another flavorful dimension to vegan desserts, the whole tome of recipes is actually sectioned off into chapters of spring, summer, autumn, and winter, each season featuring treats made with food specifically available during those seasons, which is why you'll see kiwi colada tartlets in the spring section and pomegranate granola in with winter. And to top that off, the book leads with a glossary of ingredients found throughout so that you'll have a reference for information on terms ranging from agave nectar to energy egg replacer to maple syrup to turbinado sugar, all relevant ingredients to be familiar with when making vegan recipes. And that's right, in spite of the obvious title of the book, you might be so involved with just the unique variety of the ingredients and recipes themselves that you'll forget that every single one of these creations are made with no body parts nor excretions from animals at all. And why should they be? Because baking without animal products need not contribute to cruelty. What this book is about, in my opinion, is exploring our seasonal bounties and tastes and textures and creativity to compose beautiful desserts that all can enjoy and love. And I just wanted to take a brief minute here to talk about some of the recipes that I did try out from the book, which were the coconut macaroons, the s'mores pie, the lemongrass macadamia nut blondies, and the maple pecan layer cake with gingerbread frosting, which I made for my birthday cake. I also brought all of these items to the station here for you to try out. So that would be you, Morgan, and Alyssa. Nina wasn't here, unfortunately. So let me know your thoughts on these treats from Vegan Desserts. We had, do you remember the coconut macaroons? Peanut butter covered with chocolate. I thought they were amazing.
I'm not a big fan of macaroons. So.
You hated them and you didn't even tell me. And for Morgan, actually, they're probably too sweet.
Yeah, I find most recipes too sweet. I generally cut the sugar in half anytime I make a recipe.
And I didn't know that when I brought the s'mores pie, which I think was the first one, which was, it's so decadently rich. Obviously too rich for people who can't handle the sugar, but it was so delicious. And it's showing you, it perfectly depicts what a mixture of coconut milk and chocolate will do. You freeze it, and it turns basically into ice cream, and it's delicious.
Nice.
Cream, very, very creamy. Lemongrass macadamia nut blondies. I really liked this combination. Do you remember those? I don't know.
Yeah, those ones stood out for me. I was surprised at how lemony they tasted.
That's from the lemongrass.
Yeah, normally so lemongrass.
Who would have thunk it, right?
That sounds exactly. Like a great combo.
Yeah, and who would think to like go to the store to the produce section and buy lemongrass that you're going to chop into tiny little pieces and put in your blondies? And blondies are pretty much the same as brownies for anyone who doesn't know, except they're not brown, they're blonde, hence the name blondies. And then the maple pecan layer cake, which no one here got to try out because none of you were here. I personally loved it. As I said, it was my birthday cake. I love the combination of the two flavors, the maple pecan with the gingerbread frosting that went together. And that's what I like about this book a lot, is that she thinks outside of the box to create these marriages between flavors that you otherwise wouldn't have necessarily thought of before, but they go really well together. So that is my review of Vegan Desserts by Hannah Kaminsky. And now I have our upcoming events. From now until January the 30th, there is an online fundraiser happening for the World Parrot Refuge. Songwriter Cindy O'Neill and Sora will donate 10% of the net proceeds from each download purchase of their new single called Wings in Flight to the World Parrot Refuge. Located in Coombs, BC, the World Parrot Refuge is a home for life to over 800 parrots of at least 70 species, most of which are caught or first-generation captive birds. Last summer, we did do a feature interview with Wendy Hunt-Batch, who is the president of the sanctuary, and I encourage you to find out about all the work that they are doing there. You can listen to the podcast of that show on our website at animalvoices.org, and it's the August 25th, 2011 show. And you know, I forgot to write down the website where you can actually purchase this song from Wings in Flight, but you can find a link to it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. Next week, from the 23rd to the 30th, it's the next World Week for the Abolition of Meat that is happening worldwide. This international week of activism will be accompanied by the World Day of for the Abolition of Meat on January 28th, 2012. The International Weeks for the Abolition of Meat is an initiative started in Paris, France, in 2009, and continues to take place four times a year in locales all over the world, where animal activists do outreach in their communities to educate the public on using animals as food and ultimately calling for a mandatory end to it. We actually did do an interview with one of the founders of this movement last year, and just one second here, Morgan, you need to use the other phone. Okay, sorry about that. I'm training our trainee and making announcements here at the same time. So we actually did an interview with one of the founders of this movement last year, and that interview can be heard on our May 13th, 2011 show at animalvoices.org. And for further information, you can visit the campaign's website at meat-abolition.org. On Tuesday, January the 24th at 7 p.m., it's time to get Veducated. Liberation BC is presenting a free screening of the film Veducated. This is happening at the Alice McKay Room, which is on the lower level of the Vancouver Public Library at 350 West Georgia Street in Vancouver. Veducated is a feature-length documentary that follows three meat and cheese-loving New Yorkers who agree to adopt a vegan diet for 6 weeks. There's Brian, the bacon-loving bachelor who eats out all the time, Ellen, the single mom who prefers comedy to cooking, and Tesla, the college student who avoids vegetables and bans beans. Part sociological experiment, part science class, and part adventure story, Veducated showcases the rapid and at times comedic evolution of three people who share one journey and ultimately discover their own paths in creating a kinder, cleaner, greener world, one bite at a time. And we have Marisa Miller-Wolfson, the filmmaker of this fantastic film, on the show later today. If you have any events that you would like to have announced on the show that are animal-friendly, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And I will do a station ID while we're getting a PRA set up, Morgan. You are listening to the Animal Voices show on 102.7 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! your daily grassroots global news hour. Support your independent local community radio station, Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO. Become a member today by calling 604-684-8494. Whatever you can give makes a difference. We are counting on you to stand up for independent media. 604-684-8494. And thank you so much.
Once again, this is the Animal Voices Radio Show. Today's first interview is with Peter Fricker, who is the Projects and Communications Director of the Vancouver Humane Society here in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Vancouver Humane Society is dedicated to exposing animal abuse and assisting individuals, businesses, and governments to end animal suffering, cruelty, and exploitation. Peter is here today to speak with us on one of the issues that VHS educates the public on, which is the keeping of exotic animals as pets. Hello, Peter, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us on this topic that we haven't yet covered before. However, when I read your literature about exotic pets, it brought to mind that this is probably an issue that people in our North American society don't consider much in the interests of the animals, but it's a very relevant one because it is happening. So before we get any further, can you define for us what an exotic pet is and how one differs from our domesticated cats and dogs?
Right, it's a rather loose term, but generally describes animals that haven't been domesticated and retain their wild instincts, even though they may have been bred in captivity. As opposed to cats and dogs, which have been domesticated as companions for humans for several thousand years, these animals have not adapted to living with human beings.
And what kinds of animals are people keeping in their homes in Canada as pets that are known to be exotic animals? And where are they getting them from? Are they bred in Canada or brought into the country from their native lands or both?
We're generally referring to a wide variety of animals. Probably the bulk would be reptiles, smaller reptiles, but it can range from snakes to large reptiles such as caimans, which are like a small alligator.
Mm-hmm.
There's exotic birds, parrots, cockatoos, and even primates, things like squirrel monkeys and marmosets. So there's a whole range of them, and they come from a variety of sources. There's a lot of argument about whether they're captive bred or taken from the wild. Some estimates say that there are still the majority are still being taken from the wild. I've seen estimates of up to 95%, but there certainly is an industry within Canada and throughout North America for breeding exotic pets in captivity and selling them. So they're coming from both sources.
And I understand that there's some illegal globe trade that happens with these animals. Can you talk a little bit about that, perhaps?
Sure. There is a huge smuggling industry related to exotic animals, apparently second only to the drug trade in terms of illegal activity. And again, it involves a wide variety of animals that are being taken from the wild, from rainforests in Southeast Asia, South America, Africa, and traded all around the world because there is such demand for these kinds of species. People want them for basically vanity, for novelty reasons. They're marketed by these industries to make them popular, and with the use of the internet, it's spread quite globally.
So, please tell us, why don't exotic animals make good pets? I would think that the foremost reason would be because it's cruel to keep a wild animal that should be living in his or her own natural environment.
That's exactly right. It goes back to what we were saying about these animals retaining their natural wild instincts. Basically, they've been designed by nature and evolution to adapt to a particular, very specific kind of environment, and these animals are literally being taken out of that environment and put into an environment that is completely alien to them. Now, and as a result of that, they suffer both physiological and psychological stress. They're just not suited to it. One of the big and most obvious examples of that is space. A lot of these animals in nature would have a wide territory to roam in, and that's important to many of these species. When they're put in a tank or a cage in some suburban basement, obviously they're denied that particular activity, that, and they just can't engage in that. But there's lots of specific reasons, in particular, say, with reptiles. They require a certain temperature, they require a certain amount of light, and for people who are buying these animals from pet stores or online, they obviously don't have the knowledge to try and recreate those environments, and consequently the animal will often suffer and die.
Yeah, we were talking here earlier about Nina, one of our co-hosts, who had a friend who had an iguana. She said that the iguana was sick.
Yeah, he had some issues with his skin or his scales, oftentimes.
And I wouldn't be surprised when hearing that, because they're not in their natural environments. They're not. I think even the most well-intentioned pet owners who try to recreate their animals' natural habitats with large enclosures, special diets. Would you say, Peter, that this isn't going to cut it? Like it's just not good enough for these animals?
No, that's true. There are some people who you know, go to a great deal of trouble and expense to try and recreate a suitable environment. And they know a lot about these animals. They've studied them. They've really made an effort, and in some cases, you know, they might approximate something close to you know, humane and suitable conditions. But the problem with that is that there are very few of those people, and there are thousands more who won't attain that level of knowledge or won't make that effort or spend that money. And in addition, even those people, they have to go through a steep learning curve. And we've seen evidence of this. You know, you can see, go on these reptile forums and so on, and people will say, oh, you know, my first pet died because I didn't know about the need for ultraviolet light. Mm-hmm. My second pet died because, oh, I didn't know it required this particular diet. And eventually they'll get to a position where they're not making those mistakes, but think of the amount of
all the animals
suffering
that had to die because of their mistakes that they were learning from.
Absolutely,
no,
that's
not
exactly
worth it.
Right.
Yeah, and what about people, you know, there's the well-intentioned people, but then they find that they can't care for the animals. For example, we were just speaking on the show about the World Parrot Refuge that takes in hundreds and hundreds of these parrots from everywhere, from people who are abandoning them because they can't take care of the parrots. So I would think that would be another reason, too. Can you speak a bit about people abandoning their animals and what happens to them?
It happens all the time, in particular with those exotic birds you mentioned, parrots and cockatoos and so on, is that people don't realize that they're a very high-maintenance animal. They require mm-hmm. a lot of attention. And you see, when that doesn't happen, they often engage in feather pulling, and they suffer terribly psychologically from lack of stimulation and company. Mm-hmm. They also live a long time and often outlive their owners and end up being, again, abandoned or having to go to a sanctuary. These sanctuaries are often dumping grounds for people who have either you know, been unable to care for their animal or just irresponsible. The best thing is obviously not to get them in the first place. The other problem is that people sometimes abandon them in animals into the local environment.
I know.
And that has ecological consequences. A very well-known example is with the red slider turtle, which is a small turtle that grows quite large over time. And people, you know, it was a very common pet for years. And they give them to kids, and they take them to local streams. And all over the world, the red slider has basically outcompeted local species of turtles and taken over that environment, which has, you know, changed it forever. So there are consequences like that that people don't realize as well.
And I would think, too, that it could also be a serious health risk, because there's exotic animals that are carriers of disease, and when they're dumped into the local environment, as actually the pet iguana was just abandoned into the local environment, mm-hmm. that's going to be dangerous. I mean, I've seen on fictional TV shows, but I can imagine this is true as well, as exotic animals passing on disease to other animals, and that can't be good as well.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, with reptiles, virtually all reptiles carry salmonella on their skin or in their feces, and anyone handling them has a risk of contracting salmonella if they're not very careful. And a number of cases take place in North America every year of people getting salmonella, especially children, and it can be extremely dangerous and sometimes fatal.
And speaking of the dangers to people, what about other dangers, such as that these are wild animals that, as much as you think that they are tamed, I personally feel, and I have read before too, that you cannot completely tame the wildness out of an animal, and those animals can, you know, they can attack you, even their owner who is taking care of the animal.
Absolutely. Many of these exotic pets, you know, have sharp teeth and claws. They are sometimes unpredictable. They do sometimes carry disease, and all of that is a threat to public health and safety and to the individuals that are trying to care for them.
So given all these solid reasons why it's a bad idea to keep an exotic animal as a pet, why is it legal here in Canada to do so, or is it legal? What are the animal protection laws in our country like when it comes to these kinds of animals?
Well, it's a complete patchwork across Canada. Every municipality and every province has different sets of legislation and bylaws. Fortunately, here in BC, the province did decide a couple of years ago to put some exotic animal regulation in place, which did deal with a large number of species, but mostly the larger and more dangerous animals. Prior to that legislation, it was perfectly legal to keep a tiger in your backyard in BC, unless a municipal bylaw prohibited it. The other good thing is that, again, a couple of years ago, I think 2007 actually, Vancouver passed a bylaw which also dealt with a long list of exotic animals that were prohibited from either sale or ownership. And there are a number of municipalities in the Lower Mainland that have similar legislation. So there are some restrictions, not nearly as much as we'd like to see, but in many municipalities and provinces across Canada, there is no restrictions whatsoever. And the difficulty with that is that even though there are bylaws in place, it's very difficult to enforce them. And of course, these days you can order just about anything over the internet, and it's difficult to police.
So, yeah, I would think that would be an issue. Is, you know, it's all good and fine if there is a law or a bylaw, but the enforcement's going to be an issue. And just working at Vancouver Humane Society yourself, what exotic animals have you come in contact with through your organization that you've seen that have been kept here in say, Vancouver, for example?
Well, prior to the city passing the its exotic pet bylaw, one of the most common incidents were with caimans, which are a very large reptile, just like a small crocodile.
Yeah.
And there were incidents in which they were being kept in condos in Vancouver. There was an incident where one fell off a balcony. Another one was found in a child's wading pool inside a bedroom apartment. There were people keeping these kinds of animals, large snakes, boa constrictors, pythons, and so on, sometimes large numbers of reptiles and other animals in small apartment buildings. There were incidents in which the police would, you know, on a drug bust, would go into the premises and find a range of dangerous exotic animals, usually snakes, you know, things that that are usually bought for, you know, for vanity and, you know, sort of macho symbols, that kind of thing. So it's quite common, and it's probably still happening, secretly in a number of places. But one of the most important things about these bylaws and legislation, even if they're not enforced as strictly as we'd like, is that they do send a very strong message out to the public at large that this is no longer socially acceptable.
Yeah.
And most people will tend to observe that, so that at the very least it doesn't enter into the sort of mainstream popular activity that it might otherwise do.
So what's the number one thing that our listeners can do to stop the captivity and suffering of these wild animals in people's homes? I would think that education is key to start with, and obviously don't purchase these animals.
Absolutely, and they should talk to, you know, any sort of friends and relatives, people with kids who are considering buying in exotic animals because mm-hmm. they have an amazing fascination and attraction, and people just love to be able to say that I've got one of these things and nobody else does. If they come across that amongst their family, friends and acquaintances, colleagues and so on, to try and discourage that as much as possible, and you know, by all means point them to educational material, you know, on our website or on other animal welfare organizations' websites and so on. The other thing they can do is check and see whether their municipality has an exotic pet bylaw. Have a look at it, and if they don't have a bylaw, write to their council and encourage them to do so.
Well, thank you, Peter, for coming on the Animal Voices show today to speak to us on the topic of keeping exotic animals as pets. If you would like more information on the Vancouver Humane Society's position on exotic animals, please visit their website at www.vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I have some headlines for you here today. First of all, the European Union banned battery cages for egg-laying hens. That law was finalized in 1999, but it was actually just finally implemented as of January 1st of this year. It was a 12-year sort of phase-in period. Some farms are opting for a more free-run approach, while others have incorporated enriched cages, which allow for some more room. A roost on an elevated platform and a designated nesting areas. These are all sort of things that hens need. That's their natural capacity, is to want to get away from the flock and have a special place to lay their eggs. They get really distressed if they don't have that. Have you guys heard about that at all? Or
I hadn't until you just said it, and I think this is wonderful news. Now, you said that this law had been passed in 1999?
Yeah.
So it's now how many years
12
later?
Years.
12 more years that the animals had to wait for this to happen.
Of course, this is an expensive transition, and there's a price issue now with the eggs. Imported eggs are actually now cheaper than a lot of the local eggs that aren't using battery cages, and there's a lot of countries that actually aren't enforcing the rule at all. So the EU Commission plans to take legal action against 13 countries that aren't participating right now. Germany was actually a front runner with this. They actually banned the practice in 2007, and I guess that means they're trying to enforce it. So good news for hens in the European Union, hopefully.
And I hope that North America will follow suit.
Yeah. And next year, actually, the European Union is banning gestation crates for pigs, which are the they're the small cages where the mama pigs can't even move over or roll over, or really stand up. They're kept in there for months at a time, and they can barely move at all. It's pretty depressing. And then I just have. In Ottawa, actually, just a little news piece that's kind of sad. On Wednesday, a dog and her puppies were rescued from the back of a pickup truck where they'd been left overnight for as long as 10 hours outside of the SPCA. And the dog was apparently in labor. It's pretty heartbreaking. Four of the nine puppies froze to death in the morning when the SPCA workers got there. They managed to rescue five of them and the mama, and they named her Nala, and they moved her and her puppies to Valley Boxer and Mastiff Rescue Home. So, yeah, I hope they find warm, cozy houses, and I hope that the person who dropped them off is feeling really, really guilty about that because that's just a terrible, terrible thing to do.
I hope they get caught
it's
and punished.
It's so cold out there, I know.
Alternatively, they could have just waited until the morning and brought the pets.
I know, I guess, I don't know, like, what happened? They just freaked out because the dog was going in labor and they just didn't want to deal with it? Like, what is going through people's heads? I don't understand.
Craziness.
And there may have been an animal emergency clinic that they could have gone to as well if they knew if there was one there, you know?
Yeah.
It was good to check about that option.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that was the only one in the area. But terrible, terrible. And in other sort of dog news, locally, I don't know if you guys heard at all that it's illegal now in Vancouver. There's a bylaw that people aren't allowed to tie up their dogs outside on the street while they go in to shop and stuff.
Okay, I didn't realize that was out on the street. So what are they supposed to do with their dog? Because you're not allowed to take dogs into the stores here in Canada. You can in Europe, but that's a no-no in Canada usually.
I guess the idea
don't
is
take your dog.
When you're walking your dog, that's what you're doing. You're walking your dog. You're not going shopping. And yeah, just leave him at home, safe and warm.
Well, on that note, and that's something to think more about, I'd like to talk more about that later. Today's main interview is with Marisa Miller-Wolfson, who is the writer, director, and editor of the feature-length film Veducated, which recently won Best Documentary at the Toronto Independent Film Festival. As a full-time food activist, Marisa has organized roughly 70 grassroots workshops and screenings of award-winning documentaries about healthy, humane, eco-friendly eating all across North America. She decided to tell a story that hadn't been told on film before and completed Veducated with the help of colleagues at the Film Shop and the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective. Veducated is a guerrilla-style documentary that follows three meat and cheese-loving New Yorkers who agree to adopt a vegan diet for 6 weeks and learn what it's all about. Making its rounds at screenings across North America, Veducated will debut here in Vancouver next week with a free showing at the Vancouver Public Library on January 24th. Hello, Marisa, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this since, last summer.
That's great. Wow, that's wonderful to hear. So thank you for coming on the show today. And I have actually been looking forward to this since last summer, too. I've been wanting to have you on the show since I met you last summer at the AR conference and after watching the film there myself. Since then, it's been getting lots of hype in the animal rights community as well as the mainstream media as a film to watch. This is an activist film, and being that you are an activist for the animals, to start, can you tell us about your roots in animal activism and becoming vegetarian and vegan? How did you start in it all?
Sure. Well, I've always been an animal lover. You know, I was that person who would take in little stray animals and try to rehabilitate them, or make my mom do that when I was a kid. And then I was at church one Sunday, my Unitarian Universalist congregation, and some kind of nutty, as I thought, animal lady invited me to see a screening of a film that sounded harmless, so I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. It's called We Are All Noah, and I watched it, and it just cataloged how animals are treated and, all across the board, animal testing, factory farming, blah, 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 and I decided right then and there that I was going to go veg, and at the screening was Mary Max, who then became my sort of veg and then vegan mentor and then executive producer of this documentary. We started a nonprofit called Kind Green Planet. And then I traveled all around the country and held screenings, organized and held screenings of, you know, award-winning documentaries like The Witness, like People mm-hmm. Kingdom, like Earthlings. The more I got into it, I thought someone should really make a film that's like this or like that. And then Mary said, well, why don't we make one? So we did.
That's great to hear. So I have talked a bit about the film today, but haven't given too much of it away. Can you go more into what the premise of the film is about and what inspired you to make it? And I know that the film Super Size has something to do with it. Super Size.
Yeah, it sure did. Well, the premise is that we take three meat and cheese lovers from different backgrounds and have them go vegan for 6 weeks. And they got hands-on, you know, training on how to be vegan, but also why to be vegan. So we did a lot of had a lot of firsthand, you know, adventures and experiences snooping around a factory farm, you know, visiting an egg farm, going to a vegetarian conference, and then I gave them cameras so that they could document how they were doing on their own time with their own families and also on vacation. So it basically shows the evolution of a veg-conscious person from someone eating bacon cheeseburger deluxes on day one to, you know, on, you know, day whatever at the end of 6 weeks. I can't do the math right now. they were like, wow, vegan really is the way to go. And it did come from, as you said, Super Size Me. I was sitting there, and I was thinking, okay, if Morgan Spurlock can detox on a vegan diet, you know, why can't we show a film? Why doesn't someone make a film showing the reverse of Super Size Me and also include the ethical issues? While health is certainly important, I'm really an animal activist at heart, and I really wanted the ethical part of this about veganism to be the main focus of the film. So we did a casting on Craigslist and found our three people.
Yeah, and it's great how you show how you found the people in that you just put it on Craigslist. Craigslist is good for a lot. So what has the response been like from the public about Vegucated? What is the feedback that you've been getting from both vegetarians and omnivores alike? How is it affecting people, and is this a goal that you had in mind?
It certainly was a goal to have people watch the film, start talking about the issues, and be inspired to take the next step, whatever that means for them, whether it's a Meatless Monday, whether it means vegetarian, or whether it means vegan, which is obviously my my objective. But any, you know, we applaud any movement in a more plant-based direction, and we think it should be celebrated. And I think that comes across in the film, and people really respond to that. And I, you know, having done screenings of other films, the Q&As were really very charged emotionally, and we've had some Q&As that have been very charged, but they've all been positive, no defensiveness, and people, you know, emailing, posting, messaging me saying, love the film, loved the humorous approach, loved the inclusive tone, and I've decided to go veg or vegan, and people are spreading it throughout their workplaces, like, oh, I gave it to so-and-so, she went vegan, I gave it to so-and-so, and mm-hmm. he's going veg, and What I didn't expect was even the farming community to be supportive. I had the daughter, a farmer's daughter, her parents run a CAFO in Minnesota, come up to me, and she said, you know, I really enjoyed how you had compassion for the farmers. And I was like, well, that's interesting. So it's been great. We've had so many people going veg or vegan from it, and it feels amazing.
Well, I think that the main reason that this film has been met with success is because it's delivered in a fun and light manner, which is a way that is accessible to everyone. When you're laughing at the trials and tribulations of the film's subjects, it's not going to make one feel guilty or bad about, say, one's own dietary and lifestyle habits. However, it does make them think. It's not that kind of movie. It's certainly no Earthlings. Would you say that this was done in a purposeful way? This was a purposeful strategy on your part to make it a humorous film while still keeping the focus intact?
You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what I was going for, because I thought a spoonful of sugar will help the medicine go down, number one. So people will stay in the film. The thing about having done screenings of Earthlings, a third of the people would walk out. And I thought, okay, we want just enough info so that people will feel motivated to learn more and think critically and make changes, but not too much will it be where they'll shut down. And, you know, humor is just part of my personality, my activism. I used to do sketch comedy, and I picked funny people on purpose because I wanted this film to be entertaining and engaging in something, most importantly, a film about this issue that you can feel good about sharing with your friends and family, knowing they're going to enjoy it, and they're not going to be like, oh, she made me watch this, you know, thing, and it was awful, you know.
Totally. So
that was the goal.
Apart from being funny people, why did you choose the main characters in the film, Tesla, Ellen, and Brian, to profile on their vegan journeys? Do you think that they depicted a typical slice of North American society that people would be able to relate to?
I think they did. They are all New Yorkers, and I think New Yorkers are kind of their own special breed, but I think the challenges that they have are entirely universal. And sort of the personality, not really types, but like, for example, you know, Ellen is a working single mom. She's juggling all kinds of jobs. She doesn't have time to cook and mess with this. Mm-hmm. But she cares about health. She's a doctor, and she cares about her kids' health. And we thought, well, that would, you know, that would appeal to moms. And then Brian is a 20-something-year-old bachelor from Manhattan who eats out all the time. His fridge is just stocked full of beer, and that's about it. And then there's Tesla, who struggles with her weight and wants to be healthier and, you know, look good and feel great. And she, you know, lives at home with her Latin American family, who have, don't really have much of a frame of reference for this lifestyle and don't really support her in this. So we thought, you know, we want, it would be nice to have a cross-section of folks with different challenges so that people could see themselves and their own experiences being reflected in the journey and say, oh, well, if she can do that, then I can do this. Or if he's, you know, he has a point there. I agree. I identify with him.
Can you talk to us more about some of the challenges that Tesla, Ellen, and Brian faced in this film in transitioning to a plant-based diet that were perhaps typical of what other people face, and what are effective ways that these challenges may be met and overcome?
Yeah, like I said, Ellen struggled with time, you know, sort of time management, mm-hmm. and struggled with that. And she has found ways. We didn't really capture that in the film, but since then she's, you know, emailed me and said, oh, I discovered this or that. She loves stir fries that are quick and easy. She does soups now, just canned soups when she doesn't have time, and adds quinoa to those, or some other kind of brown rice or grain. She's, you know, she's been really proactive. But what we see her in, her transition in the film is what's really exciting to watch is her getting her kids on board, because she's excited for health. You know, 9-year-old kids aren't really going to care about health, but then they cared about the animals when they right. visited a farm animal sanctuary, so she got their support. And speaking of family support, Tesla's biggest challenge, mm-hmm. Even though she doesn't like vegetables and beans, was not having the family support. And you could see that in the film. Her boyfriend was in the film was like, oh, I don't really like this. And I'm like, well, you know, spinach nuggets, gross. And in the film, Brian says, and Brian's been through the 6 weeks of this project, he's like, yeah, at first you're like, ew, spinach nuggets, yuck. And he said, but your tastes really changed. And by the end, you're like, spinach nuggets. So Harry kind of, even after the filming, got more and more veg-educated through Tesla. They have since gotten married, and now he is actually on a mostly vegetarian diet. So having his support has been absolutely pivotal in, you know, sticking with being vegetarian. And Brian didn't really have many struggles, to be honest. He's found delicious foods that have replaced the foods that he, you know, used to eat and love. He is in the kitchen more. He's cooking. Mm-hmm. His fridge is full now. He's actually developed a real love for cooking, and he loves to eat out, and still eats out all the time, just vegan. So it is hopeful. You can, you know, it's a learning curve at first, but with some creativity and some time, you can find it totally enjoyable and fulfilling and satisfying.
So when it comes to considering the animals when taking on the lifestyle change towards veganism, what is a common thread that you have observed in people when they are beginning to make that connection between animals and their food?
So a common thread is, it's very cute. I mean, they feel really bad, you know, when they find out what's been going on. There's a lot of guilt, and they often say, oh my gosh, I'm never going to do this again, and they are decided, okay, this is it for me. But then once they get into the how-tos, then they kind of struggle, and then you add the social component, which I think is the biggest challenge. You know, then you're adding in, you know, an element that complicates it. But like I said, if you're able to just stick through it, you know, let your body adapt, let your circle of friends adapt, you know, the transition, you'll just get through it. But there certainly are common threads, and it's really fun to watch. You know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about when people discover new things that they love, you know, like, I never had almond milk before, it's so great. And it's, you know, it's it's really fun to watch the transition.
Speaking of almond milk, I made my own almond milk for the first time this year, and because it's, or this week actually, because it's the new year and we've been talking about going vegan for 2012, what tips can you offer our listeners for keeping their New Year's vegan resolutions?
I would say, you know, watch, first of all, congrats on your almond milk. I've yet to make homemade almond milk, but everyone...
It's so easy, you have to do it.
Do you a blender, and then do you add a little bit of cinnamon and all of that?
It's just almonds, water, a few dates, and a bit of vanilla, and you don't need a Vitamix, as I discovered this week. Super simple. Mm-hmm. I don't know why more people don't do it. So I guess number one, make your own almond milk. But what tips would you have for, say, brand new people who that might be a bit daunting for?
Yeah, I would say to try all kinds of different brands and all different kinds of things. You know, some people, you may not like rice milk. You may love almond milk, but you may not like one brand. You may like another brand. Consider it an adventure. Just consider yourself a cultural and culinary pioneer, because that's kind of what we are, and embrace it. Have fun with that and be like, I'm on the cutting edge. I'm having fun discovering new foods that I've never eaten before. And before you know it, they'll be staples. You know, I'd never had quinoa before. I'd never even tasted kale, and I love it. I love them both. I eat them all the time. So you will get new favorites. Don't fear scarcity. Do plan ahead so that you're not hungry. You know, there's a little bit more thinking involved, especially in the very beginning, but you'll be fine. And most importantly, consider it an adventure and embrace it.
So can you please tell us about Vegan at Heart, which is an email program that you've started to coach people in vegan eating?
Vegan at Heart, thank you for the plug on that. Vegan at Heart is an email coaching program that inspires people with daily tips and information for 30 days on how to become more vegan. So it's geared towards people who consider themselves vegans at heart, but not necessarily in practice. And we just, like I said, involve just share practical info, so no preaching. And then the idea is for, you know, after the 30 days, we'll put you on the newsletter, so you'll get, follow-up tips and tricks. I put it on hold a little bit while I'm working on the Veducated Challenge. We're going to add a whole community part to our website and a whole challenge element to, you know, having watched the film, Now What? Because even though we've released the film on DVD and we've had a lot of our North American premieres, I think now, over the next year, is when most people are just going to start seeing the film, and we want to offer them support. So whether they sign up for Vegan at Heart, which is up and running right now, you can go to veganatheart.org, you will get on the list later, once you've done your 30 days for the challenge and our emails and tips related to the challenge and veganism.
So with the release of Educated, you've used film as an activist tool to open the eyes of people who might otherwise never be reached by this subject matter. What are your thoughts on using film and video for activism, and what advice can you offer animal advocates who wish to pursue this method of activism but don't know how or where to start?
I think video activism is so important because, you know, there are people, I do meet them every day, who just have an aha moment and they decide to go veg. But if a picture is worth, you know, 1,000 words, I think a video or a film especially is worth 1,000,000. That's what brought me to this issue, and I've seen the transformations across the board. And that's why I focus on film outreach and advocacy, because people really love story and they really love to be in community, also experiencing a film with others and then being able to talk about it afterwards. They're not just at their computer reading an article and then being like, oh, what am I going to do? Well, if you're at a film event, like a community screening, you can talk about it and meet people and find support. So for advice for potential filmmakers, I would say surround yourself with filmmakers, sort of infiltrate the filmmaker community. I did. I joined the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective and then the Film Shop Filmmakers Collective. And I had never even taken a film class, and you don't need to. Everything's been democratized. You can do it yourself. But I strongly recommend you know, reaching out and finding help from filmmakers. And also, don't just screen it to your friends what you've done. They're going to say nice things. You don't need nice things. You need honest things. And one thing that Howard Lyman told me, you know, Mad Cowboy, mm-hmm. when he was making his documentary, when he just finished his documentary, Mad Cowboy, was that the true editing starts when you start screening it, and it's mm-hmm. a long process. So be prepared and be in it for the long haul. But if you're passionate about animal activism and veganism, you're passionate about film, it really is so fulfilling to have gone on this journey and be out on the other side and actually seeing, you know, the fruits of my labor after all these years. But it is a marathon and not a race, so I would want people to keep that in mind.
That's all really great advice. Very quickly here, can you, to conclude the show, can you tell us about some ways that people can watch the film if they can't get to a live screening? I know you're on iTunes, on Amazon Instant Watch, and you can buy DVDs too.
That's right, you've got it. And you can sign up to host your own screening. And even if there, if there's not one near you, well, go to getveducated.com, sign up, you know, where you want to host it, when. And there's, we have, you know, just small license fees, not like most documentaries. They're less than most. And then we will offer support. So we'll make custom flyers for you. We'll make a custom Facebook page for you. We will support you. We'll help promote your events as well. Digitally you can watch it on DVD and attend or host the screening.
So thank you so much, Marisa, for coming on the show today to speak with us about the new film, Veducated, which will publicly debut in Vancouver next Tuesday, January 24th at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library. To learn more about the film and to view it yourself, you can visit www.getveducated.com and also follow Veducated on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks so much again, Marisa.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's another great show from Animal Voices. Two great interviews today. Thank you so much for listening. Just an addendum to something I mentioned in the show today. I said there's a new bylaw about dogs being tied up outside of shops and such. If you see a dog in that situation, the best place to call is just 311. That's Vancouver's general information line, and they can direct you. And, of course, please keep in touch with us on Animal Voices and tell your friends. Our show is only as effective as the number of listeners we have. And, of course, hours of planning and research and love go into every show. So, please, we urge you to spread the word. Find our page on Facebook and share Animal Voices Vancouver. We'll give notices about upcoming shows and alert members when our podcasts are ready. We tweet weekly from Animal Voices YVR. Follow us. Our website is animalvoices.org. You can find videos there and past shows. We love when listeners get in touch. Please email comments and suggestions to radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Animal Voices airs from Vancouver every Friday on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO and streams live from coopradio.org. Co-op Radio is Vancouver's only listener-sponsored radio station. We rely not on corporate sponsorships and commercials, but on direct donations from our members and listeners. Please call 604-684-8494 to become a member or to find out about membership on coopradio.org. Next week, we'll talk about the Vancouver premiere of Veducated and discuss the World Day for Abolition of Meat, which is January 28th. Allison will be presenting a review of an adventurous and enticing new cookbook called Healthy Voyagers Global Kitchen.
Chose my recipes last night.
Nice. 150 plant-based recipes from around the world. And we'll leave you today with a song composed by David Fishoff. It's featured in the new movie, Veducated. Heartfelt thanks again for listening to Animal Voices, and remember to always be kind to animals.